Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What I Tell My Patients, New Treatments and Clinical Trials. This is an NCPD webinar series that's a follow-up to the 2023 ONS Congress. And today we're going to be talking about colorectal and gastroesophageal cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Kristen Siomber from the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center in Nashville, and Ms. Mandy Wagner from The Ohio State University in Columbus. If you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about it, as many of these as we have time today. We have just a one-minute quick pretest for you to take in the chat room, if you can do that, and also take one at the end of this program. You'll get a lot more out of that. We'll learn a little bit about you. We're back from ASCO and I'm ramping up for a bunch of webinars this summer. Tomorrow we're going to do a program on actually Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, because we want to hear what Dr. Flynn has to say about the new Hodgkin study that was just presented at ASCO on first-line treatment. And then on June 28th, we're going to be follow up the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting with a program on endometrial cancer. And this is going to focus on two gigantic studies just presented in the last couple of months on endometrial cancer and kind of what they're going to mean. We have another ONS follow-up program on July the 6th on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. That's always a great topic to talk about. For those of you who are into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a program we did on gastroesophageal cancers. These are the 10 programs that we did at ONS. As always, it was really an incredible experience, really trying to provide an update on what's been happening, particularly over the last year or two, in clinical research and what it means, and really how to talk to patients about some of the newer therapies. This is the second webinar program. We did one a couple weeks ago on a bladder cancer, same format. This is the way we approach these programs. We are going to focus on new clinical research, but also on patient education. We're going to talk a little bit about the relationship we have to patients and how much it means to them. And in particular, our sort of biopsychosocial theme of why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient in the same oncology situation, but a different person. And Mandy's going to present four cases today very briefly, and that'll sort of be the emphasis of that discussion of those particular cases. So here's where we're heading. We're going to start out, just chat a little bit about clinical research in general, and then we'll get into some updates on some of the trials that have come out over the last couple of years, some, not all of them, that have had a big effect on clinical practice, what it means in terms of some of the new treatments you're going to see, and what to say to patients when they ask you about this. But first, just a little bit of background. You know, we always talk about clinical research. So first of all, I didn't realize that the two of you worked together at Ohio State. So I guess there's a little bit of reunion. I don't know if there are any patients we're going to talk about today, Kristen, that you saw with Mandy there. But let's just talk a little bit. Kristen, you can provide a little bit of an overview of the types of clinical trials that patients in oncology clinics go into. We talk about so-called phase one, the first type of trials, you know, getting hints from the laboratory. A lot of the therapies now are targeted and have novel mechanisms, very different than chemotherapy. Then once sort of the dose and all sort of figured out, we go to the phase two and then phase three. Can you kind of explain what happens with these trials and then how does that lead to, you know, FDA approvals and us being able to use them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting and really complicated process, to be honest. So, and something to remember is that even before patients enroll in the phase one studies, these agents and these regimens have been used and tested for years and sometimes decades, both in the lab and preclinically, you know, in mice and other animals. So it's not like patients are guinea pigs by any means, but really, you know, once they hit the phase one setting, they look very promising already, but we need to nail down the dose and also start exploring efficacy in different types of settings. So that's often a variety of patient types and tumor types, and that's usually the first kind of testing for patients of a drug or a regimen. And then if we see that we find a dose that is tolerated and that there may be a hint of signal of efficacy, it can move into phase two, usually in different specific tumor types. So not all comers as much as the phase one is. And then finally, phase three is really testing that new agent or regimen against the standard of care, the current standard of care, to see if it will change practice. And then after that is really usually when the FDA decides whether this will be an approved drug for everyone.
So, Mandy, I'm curious the kind of reactions. You know, you're in a major research center there at Ohio State, a lot of research going on. But many of the patients who go into trials are in community settings. But what kind of reaction do you get from patients when they bring, when you bring up the issue? Or do they feel like, Kristen was mentioning, feeling like a guinea pig, or see this as a potential opportunity?
I think we get both sides. You get patients that are coming from the community that may have progressed on all standard therapies and really have no other options and are still in pretty good shape, that they're willing to do whatever they can to potentially stay alive. Where you might have another patient that comes in, either it could be newly diagnosed versus, you know, someone that is progressed on all standard therapy, that, you know, they're just a little leery about being a guinea pig or having to you know, a lot of our patients come from a distance. So the travel burden of having to come, you know, for labs every week or come for scans or, you know, whatever it may be, makes them a little weary about clinical trials.
And, you know, the other thing about that, Kristen, is these phase three trials that you mentioned, these are usually the studies that'll get, you know, drug to come into practice where they compare it to the standard approach. It's often randomized. So the patient has to agree that the computer is going to decide if they're going to get the standard treatment, which is fine, or, you know, maybe slightly different. How do you see people are responding to that? And what do you see in terms of the benefits that patients get out of, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we're going to help future patients, but the benefits, you know, in the past, sometimes we saw trials comparing, you know, chemo A to chemo B, and you knew the patient themselves, and you know, both the therapies would be, you know, things you could use in the community. Now, so many of these trials have new agents that we've never seen before. How do you find people responding to the idea of randomization, Kristen, and why is that necessary?
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's important to remember that even if we may have a bias, we may think that the new drug is going to be better. We really have to prove that. So I always tell patients, you know, we honestly need to know. This is a question we need to answer. And while we think that the new drug may be better than the standard, we've definitely seen examples where that has not been the case. And we find that the standard is the best thing that continues to be the right choice for the patient. So so I think if the patient knows going in that, you know, we really have equipoise, we really have, you know, we're not actually randomizing them to a known inferior choice, but we really need to get this answer because it could go either way. I think one thing that I hear a lot from patients is just a leeriness to enroll to a study that's placebo controlled. And there aren't many studies these days that are actually placebo controlled. Mostly we see active arms of therapy on trials, but there are situations where placebo controlled study is really important. And I think that takes a little bit of extra discussion to understand and help the patient understand why that's important. And many of those studies, even if you're randomized to placebo, you can cross over at some point to the active drug. So there are ways to, you know, to still make it enticing and important for the patient too.
Yeah, we did a program last fall where I chatted with some different patients by a video, and I talked to this one man who had been on so-called bispecific to treat myeloma for a year and a half. He was doing great, responded, no symptoms. And I interviewed him on the day the drug was approved.
Wow.
So he'd been on it for a year and a half, which to me really kind of says, you know, this could potentially benefit. I'm sure over the years, Mandy, both of you have seen patients who went on trials who had outcomes that never would have happened. Any thoughts about that? Do you bring that up to patients, Mandy?
Yeah. I mean, especially when, like, in 2014, pembrolizumab was on in studies for MSI high colon cancer. And thinking about, I had this young lady with Lynch syndrome who was dying, and she went on that, and now she is fine. Mm-hmm. So just like trying to encourage patients that way, that, you know, these things do happen.
But I tell you what, they didn't happen very much before 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. All right, let's just sort of, we're going to breeze through a bunch of things. Like I said, we're going to talk about things for 2 or 3 minutes. We could talk about a half an hour. We just want to give you a little bit of an overview of what's new. And certainly, Kristen, no matter what type of cancer we do a program on nowadays, usually the first thing I think in this chat room is, what about circulating DNA? And we always go, well, the colon cancer people really seem to have figured that one out so far. So can you just sort of, particularly in the adjuvant setting, can you just give us a little bit of a glimpse of what circulating DNA assays are and how they're being used right now in the adjuvant setting of colon cancer?
Yeah. It's a great question. So, you know, for many years, say for a patient with stage 3 colon cancer, lymph node positive, we kind of assume that even with surgery, there's about a 50% chance of that cancer being left over, residual in the body that we can't see by scans or by our usual testing. So we've used different criteria, both pathology reports, CEA, and other things to try to determine which patients would benefit from chemo and who could actually do better and be cured with chemo as opposed to without. But we know that we're over-treating some patients who may not need the chemotherapy. So we've always been trying to find a better way to really determine which patients need chemotherapy after surgery or not, particularly in colon cancer. So that's where circulating tumor DNA comes in, where typically we're using what's called a tumor-informed assay. So basically, I explain to patients that I'm taking their tissue, their surgically resected tumor tissue, sending it generally usually off to a company, to basically interrogate their tissue, find what mutations are in their own tumor, and then develop a blood test that we can subsequently use to determine if there's fragments of DNA in the bloodstream that we can't detect any other way. So, you know, the technology has really drastically improved, and to a point where we couldn't have even imagined 10 years ago that we could do something like this, but it's improving by the day, to be honest. But there's still a lot of unanswered questions in terms of, we need to make sure, while this is a very sensitive test, it's not perfect in sensitivity and specificity. You can still have false negatives, false positives, and we're trying to understand that a little bit better before we roll it out to everybody as standard of care. So there are actually multiple ongoing studies. There's COBRA, there's Circulate in colon cancer, and multiple other studies that are looking at this in a really strategic way to see if this is something that everybody needs after surgery, and for that example.
So I was just flashing on the fact, Mandy, the last program that we did this year at ONS was on prostate cancer. And, you know, because when you think about this, is kind of like a tumor marker, you know, like CEA, but we know CEA is not all that great. But in prostate cancer, they have PSA. I mean, that works. But the one thing I hear from the prostate cancer people is a lot of the patients, they really get it in their head. You know, they are plotting it. At first, they're calling up, they're sending messages. And I don't know whether that's come to circulating DNA or not, but have you seen patients like that who sort of get a little crazy about it, Mandy?
Oh, yeah. That's kind of one of our biggest challenges with actually doing the testing, is the anxiety that we can provoke with it. And then once we get it and they're positive, what are we going to do with that information? What if their scans are negative and we don't know that there's anything there to treat yet? So it's a very long discussion about the risk benefit of doing it, but it is extremely anxiety provoking for some. But then it's also reassuring for others that are negative, you know?
Yeah, we mentioned we're going to do this, another ONS program on CLL, and they have MRD, same issue. People don't know what to do. They get all crazy about it. Here's another research advance, Kristen. I just want to profile, you know, this has been an issue for a long time now, which is optimal first-line therapy, metastatic colorectal cancer. And in particular, because we know these people in general, with some exceptions that we'll talk about, are going to get chemotherapy and a biologic. But the question is, which biologic, EGFR antibody or bevacizumab? And we saw this big paradigm study, but there are a whole bunch of studies before then, But it seems like more and more we're leaning towards, and Mandy actually has a patient who has a left-sided, quote, RAS wild-type cancer, that these patients, which is, you know, a significant number of people, are getting an EGFR antibody rather than what's been going on in the past, bevacizumab. And I'm just, maybe you can just sort of summarize what you've seen and how it's affected your choice. Are you doing that in your practice, Kristen?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we've known for about the last decade or so that it matters where the primary tumor in colorectal cancer, where it starts. And it seems to not only have prognostic implications, but predictive ones, meaning it'll, you know, having a right-sided versus a left-sided tumor, no matter what chemotherapy you get, you know, the prognosis is going to be different, but also it helps tailor which chemotherapies and biologics are going to be most important. So the Paradigm was a phase three study done in Japan by our Japanese colleagues that was really the first prospective phase three study to look at this question of whether anti-EGFR or anti-VEGF therapy in the first line was more beneficial in the overall treatment scheme. And it did confirm an overall survival benefit to the addition of anti-EGFR to backbone chemotherapy for patients with left-sided RAS wild-type disease. We're learning more details about that, so it does look like it's not just RAS, but it may be other mutations that are there as well that can help help us delineate that we may not have thought were actionable previously. So the story is still unfolding. I traditionally don't give a lot of anti-EGFR antibody in the first line, and that's largely because of toxicity. And I also use more triplet backbone chemotherapy if I'm going to be aggressive. Our European colleagues use it all the time. And you know, there are some instances in which it may be better, not only from a survival benefit, but the addition, you know, the ability to maybe even reuse anti-EGFR antibodies in the future. But it's definitely a discussion I have with the patients, because it is kind of a trade-off between toxicity and benefit too.
Yeah, it is interesting. There are a number of situations where you see difference in Europe and the U.S. Mandy, what's your take on this? In particular, as Kristen was saying, the key issue here is toxicity, particularly the EGFR antibodies. Like, what's your experience with it? Is, you know, how often do you see people really having a problem? Do you see sort of social issues that people don't want to go out in public? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, we typically do, a lot of the oncologists I do work with will choose anti-EGFR in the first line setting for RAS wild type left-sided. You know, we are managing the toxicity, which includes skin rash, which for patients, that's just very hard, especially as we're seeing younger and younger population. They're walking out and they've got this giant rash on their face, their chest, their arms, their back. So just really focusing in on the supportive care measures with them, using a liberal moisturizing cream. We typically prescribe an antibiotic, minocycline or doxycycline twice a day, steroid creams, clindamycin lotion, everything that we can do to kind of keep the rash at bay. Also dealing with the hypomagnesemia that comes with the anti-EGFR, and I've actually had some patients recently that's actually been a bigger challenge, that we're getting their magnesium levels drop so low, and it's taking a while to get them to recover. I had one lady, she dropped on cetuximab, her magnesium got down to 0.7, and it took about a month of holding treatment and 2 to 3 times a week coming in for magnesium infusions.
So let's bring a patient into this discussion. And what we're really going to focus on with these cases is not so much the complex, often course that these people have, but more sort of a broader perspective on the patient, and particularly the biopsychosocial issues. I will point out, and I didn't realize until I actually looked at the agenda, we're presenting 2 cases of colorectal cancer. And it was not by design, but both of them are under age 50 and died. So we've talked a lot in the past about the increasing incidence in younger people. Here are 2 patients like this. When you think back about this 48-year-old lady who received multiple, initially presented with left-sided RAS type disease, but when you think about her, like, what do you think about Mandy? What do you remember about her that made her different to take care of?
She always just had a positive outlook. I mean, she dealt with the cards that she was dealt. She handled it. She developed a website blog that said, "Who invited cancer to my party?" She blogged about her different experiences. Her and her husband took cooking classes, or about their travels, or about their dog or their friends, and just really tried to focus in on the joys of life.
Were the and big she had children?
Her. She did. She had two teenage, she had one daughter and one son. They were both, I think the younger one was probably 14 or 15 when she was diagnosed. And then the older one, I think, was a junior or senior. And she did live to see both of them graduate high school.
Kristen, any thoughts? You know, again, one of the themes we've had over the years at ONS has been minor children and grandchildren of patients with cancer, particularly people who unfortunately are not able to be cured. Any thoughts about your experience with patients with teenage children?
Yes. Yes, we see it so often. And I think it adds a whole layer of complexity to the case where patients, you know, we have to figure out how to tell the news to the kids and ways to make this journey really manageable for the whole family. And that can be really challenging because there are so many different dynamics, family dynamics and coping abilities among different family members. But I try to get my social worker involved, usually our psychology team, and really kind of in a multidisciplinary way, kind of surround the family, because I think that's really important. It's not just the patient going through this, but really the whole family.
All right, let's move on now. And of course, a big theme, we talked about it almost every one of the conferences at ONS, has been targeted therapy. And we actually did a program at ONS on anti-HER therapy across three cancers. So we had GI people on the stage, we had breast cancer, and we had lung cancer all together, because more and more we're seeing targeted therapy that goes across different cancers. So, of course, Kristen, where we think, when we hear about HER2, the first thing we think about is breast cancer, where, you know, this has been a huge issue now for a long, long time. So many new therapies in breast cancer. But again, we're starting to see anti-HER strategies being used in other cancers. Before we kind of get into what we know about HER2-positive colorectal cancer, can you provide a little bit of perspective on this idea of finding a targeted therapy and then using it in different cancers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's become really what we do now. And 10 years ago, it wasn't a thing. We've really been focusing a lot on these smaller and smaller subsets, but really been able to see by you know, identifying these subsets and treating patients accordingly, been able to see some really huge successes too. And I know that we have further to go, but, you know, it's HER2, it's BRAF, it's RAS, it's MSI in colorectal cancer. So they're adding up over time, whereas each individual one may only be, say, less than 5% of the population. You know, the more targets that we identify and can treat, you know, it really does add up.
And again, you see this going across. I mentioned we're doing this program on endometrial cancer. That's a lot of that's because of MSI high endometrial cancer, where they're using checkpoint inhibitors. So it's not just one cancer. BRAF, there's an approval for dabrafenib, trametinib. It doesn't matter what cancer you have, you theoretically can use it. But let's focus a little bit more on, you know, we're going to get to upper GI cancers, where we actually have really more options with HER2 and even approved options. And we now have one approved in colorectal cancer, which is just only in the last few months. So can you provide a little bit of background on how often you see HER2 positivity, Kristen, what HER2 positivity means, and maybe talk a little bit about two therapies now. One, I call it the Mountaineer strategy, a combination of tucatinib and trastuzumab, which we also have in breast cancer, tucatinib, trastuzumab, and capecitabine. And also trastuzumab deratuxan, an antibody-drug conjugate, again used in right now in breast cancer, lung cancer, and GI cancer. So can you provide a little bit of an overview of HER2-positive colorectal cancer, Kristen?
Yeah, so this is one of the targets that we do see in about less than 5% of metastatic colorectal cancer patients. Tends to be more common in the left side and more common in the RAS wild type population, though we recently learned that that may not be an important excluding factor if you have a RAS mutation. But, you know, even before MOUNTAINEER and DESTINY-CRC01, which have been the most recent studies, we have had a variety of studies looking at trastuzumab lapatinib, trastuzumab pertuzumab, and some of the other regimens that that our breast cancer colleagues have known for a long time. But I think the most exciting recent regimens that we have data for now are, as you mentioned, the tucatinib trastuzumab. So tucatinib being a TKI against HER2, and trastuzumab being the anti-HER2 monoclonal antibody. So it just, as you mentioned, it just got that combination, just got approved in January, actually while we were at ASCO GI. So that was exciting. But what I think is really a couple of interesting points about that regimen, the MOUNTAINEER regimen, is that it's pretty tolerable. So we really don't see a lot of significant toxicities like we might see in some of the other targeted populations. And the durations of response can be really long. Like in some cases, I think the median duration of response was about a year. So really nice to see this was for patients who are RAS wild type, so, and had not received any prior anti-HER2 therapy. So it was nice to see that new approval. So that's so patients are eligible for that now, even off clinical trial. And then DESTINY-CRC01, we've known for a little while. So as you mentioned, trastuzumab deruxtecan has kind of a payload, chemo payload, and a linker. And so it's a little bit more chemo-like in terms of toxicity. A couple important things to know about that is that there is a small but real chance of interstitial lung disease. So that has to be top of mind when patients are on that drug and complaining of new cough or shortness of breath, something to really investigate quickly. But this drug looks really good too. And I think unlike breast cancer and maybe other tumor types, it does look like the copy number for HER2 is very important in colorectal cancer. So the higher the more amplified the tumor is, the better chance the patient's going to respond. And in some cases, in these very refractory tumors, we're seeing response rates of 40, 45%, really incredible. And some of these are very durable. Interestingly, in DESTINY-CRC01, many patients had already received prior anti-HER2 therapy and still benefited from trastuzumab deruxtecan. So that's exciting. And then at ASCO a couple of weeks ago, we saw that we could probably even decrease the dose from 6.4 mg per kg to 5.4, still works just as well with less toxicity, and also saw a signal that maybe the RAS status doesn't matter and that patients could still benefit if they have RAS mutant disease too.
So getting back to the tucatinib trastuzumab by the MOUNTAINEER approach, and another thing, you know, again, themes in oncology is often the trials that we were talking about earlier start out in very late disease. And once you see that it works there, you start doing trials earlier and earlier, even up to the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting. One of the things that we talked about, Kristen, we always talk about ONOS, because I find it so informative, are these so-called waterfall plots, where each one of these lines represents a patient. And if it goes up, it means it's the size of the tumor you're plotting here. So if it goes up, it means it's getting worse. If it goes down, it means it's shrinking. And you can see if it goes down, it completely goes away. It's a complete response, as you can see here in the blue. But you can see that most patients have tumor shrinkage. You were talking about the durability. What about tolerability? One of the things that comes up in breast cancer that we've heard about, again, it's a combination in breast cancer. And with breast cancer, they're given capecitabine as well, which has toxicity. But here, it's just tucatinib and trastuzumab. Oh, in breast cancer, we'll hear about diarrhea, Kristen. What do you see with the MOUNTAINEER approach?
Yeah, I think with tucatinib trastuzumab, we do see mostly GI side effects, but they're relatively mild compared to some of our IV cytotoxic chemotherapies. So in relation to that, it seems a little bit easier on patients.
And the other thing, of course, again, going along with this idea of moving things up earlier is now going into first-line therapy, because this was with second-line and beyond. But now there's a study that's going to look at it. Any thoughts about this? And it's going to be interesting to see what it's like to actually get chemotherapy plus these anti-HER strategies. Any thoughts about this trial, Kristen?
Yeah, so we're participating in this study and really looking forward to kind of seeing how patients do, because we've seen in other cases and other tumor subtypes that, you know, perhaps adding a targeted approach plus chemotherapy can improve response rates and in some cases survival. So that's what we hope we see. You know, one important thing I think we have to remember when we think about these first line studies is the importance of sending molecular testing early, because we're really making decisions, a lot of decisions now from the get-go, you know, before we can even, we used to just say, oh, we'll start with chemo and figure it out later. And now really we need to know all the subtypes, you know, the HER2 status, the RAS status, the MSI status, before we even choose a therapy, because the therapies can be drastically different now.
And we know that, you know, not everybody in clinical practice gets optimal therapy. Sometimes there are, you know, social or insurance blocks to getting optimal therapy. But one thing nurses can do in an oncology clinic, for example, if you see a patient who's got metastatic colorectal cancer, they should have a bunch of biomarkers on their chart. You know, HER2, we just talked about, particularly if they have metastatic disease. MSI status, BRAF, we talked about RAS. That's one thing that's helpful, is to just see what kind of workup the patient has. You don't have to necessarily know whether the therapy is correct or not, but if they don't have those markers done, you're not going to be aware of that. And that ties into BRAF, and we were talking about BRAF therapy before, also an option, different in terms of how it's approached. We're going to hear Mandy in a second about your patient, but I'm just curious before we get into that case, Mandy, you're a 47-year-old farmer. Just taking a step back, what have you seen in terms of tolerability to these anti-BRAF regimens? Because here, not only do you have a BRAF inhibitor, but you also have anti-EGFR antibody. So what do you actually see, Mandy?
So unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of patients that have made it far enough to get this therapy, just because the aggressive nature of the BRAF mutation. But the ones that do are able to go on it so far have been tolerating fairly well. I mean, dealing with nausea, a lot of the GI side effects from encorafenib, as well as rash. We also always make sure to get a baseline EKG completed as well, because it can cause QTC prolongation. So we will monitor that during therapy. And then with the anti-EGFR, with the cetuximab, again, kind of all of the same rules apply for, you know, talking about supportive care up front, starting right away with your minocycline, doxycycline, moisturizing cream several times a day, sun, protecting yourselves from the sun. And overall, patients have done well. And the few that I've seen being able to get on and stay on therapy for a while, I have seen them improve clinically in regards to their cancer.
So come back to you, Mandy. A couple of quick questions from the chat room. Ibrahim wants to know, what do you do with patients who are intolerant to doxycycline? Is there an alternative antibiotic that you can use? And also another question, any treatment for the hypertrichosis for the anti-EGFR antibodies other than stopping it?
So other alternatives that we've done for antibiotics, I've done like pulse dosing of zithromycin. So usually like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, every week they'll take. There was another patient this recently that I was looking at another antibiotic, but I can't remember offhand. Kristen, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, one of my dermatologists actually taught me a trick. So especially for if you get some pustular lesions from the acneiform rash, which often you can find a couple here and there, you can actually culture that and make sure that even if the patient who's tolerating doxycycline or minocycline, it might not be the best drug. So I've found a couple of instances in which I've switched to Bactrim or even Keflex or other things on the basis of sensitivity, because there can be that super infection. So not only for rash prevention, but also to heal up that super infection too.
So I want to hear about your case, Mandy, but in a second. But I have to admit, I had to just look up what hypertrichosis is, which is excess hair growth. Which, Kristen, I didn't realize that you see excess hair growth with anti-EGFR antibodies. I don't think
I've
heard that.
Absolutely. One thing in particular, the eyelashes. So you have to be really careful, and you have to tell patients that they have to trim their eyelashes regularly, because I've seen instances where you can get corneal irritation and keratitis and really deal with severe eye toxicity just because the eyelashes get so long that they start causing problems.
So again, we're not going to get into detail about this is a sad, unfortunate situation in terms of the clinical course of this, again, young patient, 47-year-old man, a farmer who died of BRAF mutant disease. But again, Mandy, just reflecting back on what it was like to take care of him, what were some of the things that stick in your mind about this case that made it different?
So he was very independent. Again, we know he's young. He lived in rural Kentucky. He had a very supportive family that was actually up here in Ohio, who would have done anything for him. When he came to his appointments, though, he always came alone. Offered many times to have him bring either his mom or his sister in with him. He had recently been divorced, so that was kind of a struggle for him as well. But I think his family struggled with his death because they didn't understand, because they were probably never told, kind of the seriousness of his condition and how aggressive of a cancer he had.
So what about the issue of the young patient, Kristen? Can you talk about what we're seeing? And it seems like, and it's been documented, we have data, we are seeing more people who are younger, particularly under the age of 50, with colorectal cancer. Any thoughts about why? I always like to ask people why they think we're seeing this. Usually people bring up something about the microbiome in the gut. Tony Saab, who worked with both of you, you were all together at Ohio State. I remember you said you should tell your kids to put their mouths on the doorknob so they get better, more flora in their, whatever. You know, Tony has a way of being funny. But anyhow, yeah. Why do you think we're seeing so many young people with colorectal cancer, Kirsten?
It's really scary. And we don't know the whole answer. You know, there's a lot of work being done to look at this. It doesn't seem to be purely genetic. It's not like all these patients have Lynch syndrome and there's an uptick in Lynch. It doesn't seem to be that. It might be somewhat environmental lifestyle factors, but clearly there's no one clear answer. You know, there are some risk factors, diets high in red meat and low in fruits and vegetables and sedentary lifestyle and all these things. But if you look at my clinic and my 20-year-olds with colon cancer, they're all marathon runners who are slim. And, you know, so nothing is, we haven't found the magic bullet so far in terms of what's causing this, but there are a lot of research efforts underway to try to figure this out. In the meantime, we have at least decreased the age of screening for everyone at average risk for colon cancer. So now instead of starting at 50, we start at 45. That is clearly not the panacea, but at least will help. I've got mine scheduled for later this year, in fact.
Yeah, well, there also, this might be where blood work, you know, maybe some kind of circulating DNA, I don't know, you know, something like that. I mean, I don't think people can just keep going in for colonoscopy till they're 20 years old or whatever.
It's a great question. And especially with the screening. Hopefully maybe one day there'll be a blood test that we can do. It can look for all cancers. And really that's in the works. We're just trying to validate that.
It is in the works and we need it. We're going to go on and talk about gastroesophageal cancers. But his final thought, getting back to younger patients, any comments, Mandy, on your experience with younger people with colorectal cancer?
So I think, you know, a lot of these patients will have symptoms. They'll be bleeding or they'll have change in bowel habits and they'll see their primary care doctor and they're like, oh, you're too young. It's not colon cancer. You probably have a fissure or a hemorrhoid. I wouldn't worry about it. And then before you know it, they have metastatic colon cancer. So I think it's just really important to not always just push it under the rug that it's a hemorrhoid, it's a fissure, it's something else, and not colon cancer, because we are seeing it so young.
That's such a great point. All right, let's talk about gastroesophageal cancers. Used to be there wasn't that much to say. Now you can barely talk about it in a couple hours, but We just picked out a few of the highlights. Before we get into, again, some of the research advances, Kristen, can you kind of provide an overview, you know, of where these cancers are, how the patients usually present, and usually what kind of therapy they get?
Yeah, so we're seeing, especially in the U.S., we see a lot of gastroesophageal cancer, so lower GE junction, and often associated with GERD and Barrett's over time, as opposed to the pattern we used to see, which was more tobacco and alcohol related and more proximal esophageal cancers. So we definitely see more adenocarcinomas than squamous cells, as opposed to, you know, they see more squames in Asia. It's not as common in the U.S. but as in Asia, but it's something we definitely see and can be a really aggressive cancer. So it's nice to see that now we have a little bit more in terms of targeting and some patients who are really living a long time and potentially even getting cured from therapy.
So one of the interesting and challenging things I can tell you from the oncologist programs we do is how to figure out how to treat these people, particularly as it relates to the use of immune therapy. And again, we could spend a long time talking about not only metastatic disease, but actually adjuvant therapy. And now we're seeing adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor trials, approvals. We've seen it in lung cancer, and we've seen it in upper GI cancers. And of course, we've seen it in melanoma, adjuvant therapy with a checkpoint inhibitor. So this has only come about in the last couple years. And before we get into sort of the research that led into it, why don't we just talk about a patient who actually got the treatment, who actually was a nurse or a retired nurse. Mandy, what happened with this 55-year-old woman?
So she had a longstanding history of GERD that recently had, or at the time had progressed. So she ended up getting an EGD to evaluate it that did show, unfortunately, adenocarcinoma at the GE junction. Her staging workup found that it was found to be locally advanced, meaning there was some lymph node involvement, but no evidence of distant metastases. So she was treated with a course of neoadjuvant chemoradiation. She received carboplatin, paclitaxel, and radiation. She actually tolerated neoadjuvant therapy fine, really didn't have much in the way of toxicity that patients can have with the esophagitis and, you know, the weight loss and dehydration issues. So she did well, had surgery, and unfortunately still had a little bit of residual disease. The lymph node involvement had improved, but there was still some residual tumor at the site of the primary tumor. So she was started on treatment with adjuvant nivolumab, initially did very well, but then started developing a cough that progressed into this, I'm now short of breath and I can't even walk across the room without being winded. So she came in for kind of like an urgent visit to see me when her oncologist was out, and very much concerned about pneumonitis. So we did kind of work up. Sure enough, she did have pneumonitis. So she was started on high-dose steroids and had significant interval improvement in her symptoms. But unfortunately, we tried to wean the steroids a little too quick, and she had rebound symptoms. So we put her back on steroids and really did a very slow taper to get her off. And now she's doing well. She was very stressed about not being able to complete the remainder of her adjuvant course because she's very worried about cancer recurrence and just the stress of that happen. You know, every time she comes in for a scan, we call it skin anxiety, and she is a nervous wreck about whatever that report may say.
And again, one of the things we've talked a lot about over the years at ONS is taking care of people who are healthcare professionals, particularly if they're oncology people. This woman, I believe, was not an oncologist, I think in psychiatry. Do you think that changed what it was like to take care of her, Mandy, the fact that she was a nurse? You think that might have been connected to some of the anxiety? Was she checking her chart and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think as healthcare providers, right, we're going to look everything up. We're going to try to be as informed as we can. But then you can go down this rabbit hole of what ifs could happen to me and, you know, high likelihood with it being esophageal cancer. So just trying to be patient with her, answer her questions. She will send my chart messages in before her appointments to ask her questions ahead of time, just to help kind of ease the anxiety associated with coming to see us.
So let's talk a little bit about sort of the research that underlies what happened with this woman, Kristen. Really interesting, too, because, you know, we think about checkpoint inhibitors as so well tolerated, and most patients, they totally are. But this lady certainly did not have an easy time whatsoever with this pneumonitis. I'm really curious to see tomorrow night what Dr. Flynn says about giving a checkpoint inhibitor to these Hodgkin patients. Some of them, we have a case tomorrow for him. A patient's got a lot of disease in their lung. I was thinking, suppose this patient gets autoimmune pneumonitis. But anyhow, first let's just talk about the trial, what they looked at, Kristen, and how this strategy now is being, you know, leading to cases like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the CheckMate 577, which led to the FDA approval of adjuvant nivolumab in these patients, really was designed for patients who had that neoadjuvant chemoradiation, like Mandy said, and still had some residual disease at the time of surgery. Interestingly, so we often think in esophageal cancer, we think about PD-L1 status and it, the higher being better and more reflective of response to therapy. But in this study, it looked like independent of PD-L1 status or CPS number, that patients benefited. And it was clear curve separation, clear improvement, overall survival benefit. And I really, you know, I've seen patients cured who likely would not have been cured without it. So it's been really gratifying, especially since, you know, we always felt when we did neoadjuvant chemoradiation and then surgery, then it was just kind of like waiting for the other shoe to drop because so many patients would recur. But we never had any data that chemotherapy after surgery helped. And in fact, it was really hard on patients, especially who were recovering from esophagectomies. So being able to give adjuvant nivolumab, as you said, most patients tolerate it well. And it's not as difficult in the day-to-day as chemotoxicity is. But, you know, you certainly have to be on the alert for those severe toxicities that you have to treat early. And like Mandy said.
Mandy, any comments? So we didn't talk much about MSI high. We referred to it earlier there where, you know, checkpoint inhibitors are really effective. And, you know, other than that, we're not, you know, we're seeing the use in metastatic disease of checkpoint inhibitors. Particularly as we're talking about here in GI cancers. But can you talk a little bit about the spectrum of the kinds of autoimmune problems you see with checkpoint inhibitors in general, Mandy? And particularly I'm curious about skin because I know it's very common, like what you see there.
So when educating patients about immunotherapy, I tell them, you know, we're releasing the brakes on the immune system to attack and fight the cancer, and it can go after anything else at once. So really they need to report anything new or unusual to, you know, to the team. So most commonly we do see like the skin rash, and it can be anywhere from just dry skin and itching to an acne form rash. And I have like a guy right now that just has kind of like a macular rash to his chest and back. I see, you know, issues with hypothyroidism pretty frequently. So we routinely check thyroid function while on therapy. Issues with joints, you know, arthritis, kind of pain. And, you know, the more severe things with the colitis or pneumonitis. I had one patient that had pancreatitis, that developed pancreatitis, that she was actually, that was when Pembro was still on trial. So really just anything new or unusual, I want to know about. And kind of, you know, with the endocrinopathies that can happen, with the hypophysitis and other things, it can be so subtle. It could be, you know, all of a sudden I'm just more tired. So we might do kind of an endocrine workup for that.
So, Kristen, you know, sometimes trials get presented. Usually they get presented in a meeting and they often will get published, particularly if they're important. Somewhere along the line, if it's going to get approved, the FDA is going to evolve. But when you see, sometimes trials get presented and you go, whoa, this thing is going to maybe go into practice. I remember, I think it was only last summer, wasn't it? It seems like years ago, but that we saw the Mountaineer data. We were just talking about Tucatinib trastuzumab. That was like last June at ESMO GI, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep,
then
that's right.
It got approved in January. The paper came out. You know, I think recently also.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then last, at the last ASCO GI meeting, earlier this year, we saw phase 3 placebo controlled trial, the Spotlight study, looking at a completely different drug that we've never had before, zolbetuximab. Then there was another similar study, the GLOW study, that was presented, not that very similar study, phase three, both of these placebo-controlled. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, what Claudin 18.2 is? What about this antibody to it? And what about these two trials? Do you think this mm-hmm. is going to come into practice? Now, this is first-line therapy in metastatic disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is an exciting target. And one of the reasons it's exciting is because as opposed to some of the other subtypes where it may be located in 3-5% of patients, we actually think that more patients will be eligible for this. You know, the numbers are across the all over the map, but you know, somewhere around 20-25% of patients' tumors in specifically GE junction adenocarcinoma can express this claudin 18.2. This is a protein. It's called a tight junction protein, and it's normally expressed in gastric cells, and it becomes exposed on the surface of these cancer cells, making it a target. And so what zolbetuximab is, it's basically a monoclonal antibody, and it targets this claudin 18.2. And it looks like in combination with cytotoxic chemotherapy that there's a survival benefit. And it's nice to see, you know, now in two studies that this actually looks like there's a survival benefit. So, and they seemed very, very similar in terms of efficacy as well as toxicity. So both Spotlight and GLOW. Did seem to be GI toxicity is the most common, specifically nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And again, you're combining with chemotherapy, so you have to be careful there. But I think this looks really promising, and will be interesting to see what the FDA thinks.
And here are the progression-free survival curves that we talked about this a lot in the past. The top line there is the people who got zolbetuximab. So their probability of remaining disease-free is greater. The line is higher. If you look in the upper right, you see HR. That's the hazard rate of 0.75. Oncologists always look at that. And it kind of like what you do is subtract it from 100. So what 0.75 means is at any given point in time, there's a 25% reduction in the risk of having a relapse. But as you mentioned, what oncologists really get excited about is when they see survival benefit. A lot of times you don't see that until later, but here it's already there. Same thing, 0.75. So the chance of being alive is 25% greater at any point in time along the line. And then and it's really cool that they had these two completely separate trials, and yet the data are so similar. I mean, really, it's a real, comment about how amazing the clinical trials are that are getting done today and how reliable they are. And the one thing I wanted to ask about, and I don't think either one of you have actually used the drug, right? Am I right? Or did you use
it? I personally haven't. Yeah. So, Yeah.
I mean, this happens all the time in oncology. You know, oncologists are using drugs for the first time and they're like, we got to get this right. And mm-hmm. it seems like every time there's a new drug, there's something a little bit different. And, you know, you ask people, you read the papers and you start using it. I don't know. The one thing that you mentioned before that I think is going to be very interesting that when I've talked to people who've actually used it is what you were saying about nausea and vomiting. Because I think it's part of the reason that claudin is such a great target is there's a lot of it in the stomach. But presumably they get pretty intense because of that nausea and vomiting, like during the infusion. And I've heard that it's not that easy to deal with. Any thoughts about how you're going to be thinking through your first patient, Kristen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Assuming give it. Of course, it's not approved yet. So I would think it's going to be approved, but who knows? So what do you think? What are you going to do?
We always start with looking at how the what pre-medications were used and were allowed in the trial and try to adhere to that pretty closely or even escalate if possible. So sometimes I can't remember if it's in these two trials, but I think steroids were actually restricted initially. So that might have explained a little bit more of the nausea too. So, you know, and in some cases, this is for good reason. And there's a mechanism of action where, you know, certain medications might either be more toxic with the combination or could impair effectiveness. So I think it's really it's really, you know, necessary to look at those features. And then, you know, I'm always a fan of trying to avoid the nausea and vomiting rather than treat it, you know, so try to nip it in the bud preemptively rather than treat it once it occurs. So we're always trying to do that with all of our regimens.
So, you know, it could be in the near future, we're going to wake up in the morning, check our phones and see that this drug is approved. And we're going to have to figure out how to do it, how to do the Claudin assay, et cetera. Just to finish out, we talked before about a HER2-positive colorectal cancer. There's been a lot of developments in HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer. So let's just briefly comment on that. So first of all, Kristen, maybe you can comment on the new first-line approach to metastatic disease. Not only in the past, we know that upper GI cancers benefit from trastuzumab being added to chemo, but now it looks like most of these people have high PD-1 tumors. This trial, the 811 study, which wasn't a randomized study, really got this triplet approved. Is this the way you're approaching first-line therapy?
Yes, it is. And so this is another example where we need that molecular testing early on, right at diagnosis, because it impacts care and treatment selection. So KEYNOTE-811 was really remarkable because it actually got it got approval based on response rate, which is not a typical endpoint that that we base a lot on. We really want to see survival benefit. And, you know, we'll wait and see. It should be coming. But we saw response rate 75% or higher in this study with the combination of 5-FU and oxaliplatin and pembrolizumab, trastuzumab. So, and that was in this irrespective of PD-L1 status, actually. So you don't have to worry about that if they're PD-L1 negative. But the mechanism is such that if they're HER2 positive, then you can treat with that combination regimen as long as there are no contraindications. But we're really excited to see overall survival at some point. But the initial results look really good.
So, and we've been talking about trastuzumab deratoxin, which is actually approved in gastric cancer and being used a lot of times in second line. In a second, we're actually going to hear about a patient from Mandy who's been on it for a year and a half, which is amazing. But also, you know, again, you see these strategies where first you see a targeted therapy in one tumor and they start testing it. Other tumors makes a lot of sense to be looking at the Mountaineer strategy upper GI cancers as well, Kristen. Currently the usual second line therapy in HER2 negative patients is ramucirumab, the anti-angiogenic and paclitaxel. They're adding tucatinib and trastuzumab onto that in the so-called Mountaineer 2 study. We'll talk about TDXD in a second, but any thoughts about tucatinib and trastuzumab in gastroesophageal, Kristen? You think that's coming?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to test it out because, you know, we have better first-line agents now and regimens, and second line is really where it takes a nosedive and we need better therapies. So I think for the patients, you know, that are HER2 positive, I think the addition of tucatinib trastuzumab, you know, may be really interesting, especially with that tucatinib mechanism. And again, it seems to be fairly easy to tolerate. You know, we always worry a little bit with the esophageal patients if they can swallow pills and whatnot, but it doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. And we look forward to seeing the results of Mountaineer-02.
So just to finish out, as I said, this is a patient, amazingly, who's had metastatic gastroesophageal cancer since 2014. He was being treated when you were still at Ohio State, not by you, Kristen, but
yes.
Almost 10 years of metastatic. You know, you see this in breast cancer. Some of these HER2-positive breast cancer, they go on trastuzumab, and they're throwing it for 15 years, and nobody wants to stop it. But Mandy, this man is the most recent treatment. It has been TDXD, and incredibly, after all these prior therapies, he actually has had a response for a year and a half. But we were talking before about your nurse who had pneumonitis from checkpoint inhibitors. And of course, that's one of the big issues with trastuzumab deratoxin. You can see interstitial lung disease. Fortunately, I guess your patient hasn't had it. I'm curious how he has tolerated it, Mandy. You hear about chemotherapy-like side effects, like nausea and vomiting, occasionally hair loss. Curious whether he's had it, and kind of what his quality of life is like, and what's it like to see a man walk in who's had metastatic disease for 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that we've just been able to keep him alive this long. So on the current therapy, he has had required dose reductions due to thrombocytopenia and fatigue. And he does have some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, but those are well managed with antiemetics, antidiarrheals. That's not really been the issue, more the fatigue and then the thrombocytopenia. But he's now retired. He was kind of consulting, kind of big wig job. He would always actually work every time he came in for infusions, but he's now retired. He's enjoying, you know, spending time with his grandkids, golfing, and most recent imaging showed continued just stable disease. He had had a response and now things are kind of stabilized, but we're going to keep going.
So just final comment from Kirsten. Kirsten, any thoughts about why you see a case like this and, you know, that's so different from what you typically see? Is it the tumor? Is it the host? Is it the immune system? Any thoughts about why we can't see this more?
Yeah, I wish we knew that answer. But I think we see that in every subtype too, you know, and I think these quote unquote exceptional responders or long durable responders are really, it's important to study these things, the tumor, the host, everything that you mentioned, because we'd love to see this happen for more patients. Obviously, that's our goal, and even to cure disease more than we do. But definitely keeps us going to try to figure this out and achieve that for more patients.
Yeah, and I think seeing a patient like this keeps us going in general, too, in terms of, you know, hope for the future. So, Kristen and Mandy, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back tomorrow night, I want to see what Dr. Flynn has to say about the new first-line Hodgkin trial, but also the craziness going on with mantle cell lymphoma. A lot to talk about there. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks a lot, Mandy. Thanks, Kristen.
Yeah, thanks.